In the New Year's Eve deal, it's kind of somewhat unavoidable if we were going to get away up there this this year. But I hear it went well. Got a picture of Andrew in there preaching away. It looked pretty good. I know that Nick preached too, so that's a blessing. Lord may have exacted his revenge on us for not being here for New Year's, though. We were in a condo beneath drunks for about three nights, and so anyway, and I got a cold on top of it, so maybe I should stay home next year. Anyway, more about that later. This is a little series of things is called And Then the Fight Started. Hope your sense of humor is intact. My wife sat down on the couch next to me, and I was flipping channels. She asked, "What's on TV?" I said, "Dust." Then the fight started. My wife was hinting about what she wanted for our upcoming anniversary. She said, "I want something shiny that goes from 0 to 150 in 3 seconds. Bought her a bathroom scale. Then the fight started. When I got home last night, my wife demanded that I take her someplace expensive, so I took her to a gas station. And then the fight started. My wife and I were sitting at a table at our high school reunion. Kept staring at this very drunken lady sitting alone at a nearby table. My wife said, "Do you know her?" "Yeah," I sighed. "That's my old girlfriend. I understand that she took to drinking right after we split up those many years ago. I hear she hasn't been sober since." "Good grief," says my wife. "Who would think a person would go on celebrating that long?" Then the fight started. And finally, my favorite, and I really hope that your sense of humor is intact here. I rear-ended a car this morning, so there we were alongside the road. Slowly, the other driver gets out of the car. You know how sometimes you just get so stressed and little things just seem funny? Well, I couldn't believe it. The guy's a dwarf. So he storms over to me on his little short legs to my car, looks up at me and said, "I am not happy." So I looked down at him and said, "Well, then which one are you?" Then the fight starts. Yeah. All right, we're in Revelation. Revelation chapter 11. All right, Revelation 11 is one of those chapters in the Bible that a lot swings around. It brings a lot of things together. You understand some things after putting it together. And isn't it ironic that the Lord would put a chapter near the end of the Bible that's so important to understand? I mean, folks, there's some things in Genesis that you never would have understood had you not had the New Testament. You realize that you wouldn't have known that there was a dispute over the body of Moses, and that Moses, apparently after dying, that the body was removed and taken to heaven. You never would have known that just reading the Old Testament. You have to have a New Testament to know that. So anyway, we embark on Revelation chapter 11, and I don't have all the answers here. The Lord has interlaid, apparently, so much truth over some of these chapters in Revelation that, you know, I get bits and pieces of it. You know, I'm just reminded all the time how little I really understand. So in Revelation chapter 11, verse 1, and make sure that we know where our places are here. Notice back, and it seems like it's going back a long way, but it's not. In 9:12, notice, "One woe's past, behold, there are two woes more. The sixth angel sounded." So this is the sixth trumpet. This is after the sixth trumpet. And notice, "The seventh trumpet does not sound until 11:15. So from 9:13 to 11:15, you have some information the Lord's giving you between the final two trumpets. And presumably these fall in about that time. I don't know why the Lord would take the time to explain to you what's going on, you know, in a parenthetical scenario, if it weren't happening around that time. I mean, you don't write a sentence that way. If you write sentences, you don't put a parenthesis, you know, around a phrase or an explanation four sentences after you brought the subject up, right? So presumably what happens from 9:14 on down, you know, through chapter 10, which seems to be all parenthetical, and chapter 11, which is largely parenthetical, explaining to you these two olive branches and so on and so forth, then, you know, if it didn't happen here between the sixth and seventh trumpet, then why is it there? So that looks like that it's, you know, chronological anyway. All right, chapter 11, verse 1. So you're between the sixth and seventh trumpet. 11:1, and there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise, measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles. And the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. Okay, quite a bit of information in there. But now in 11:1, I'm going to measure a city. That brings back to memory, you know, what we went through in Ezekiel 40. This guy is given a rod, and he goes and measures, you know, all of the measurement around the temple in the millennium, the courts, the temple, you know, the staircases, you know, everything in the world, and, you know, quite elaborate stuff. Well, this is plainly not that. This is not the millennial temple. And it doesn't give you a lot of information. He says, measure this, that, and the other, including verse 1, the temple of God, altar, and them that worship therein. But then it doesn't give you any particular information about height, breadth, and lengths, and how many, and all that kind of thing. But it reminds you of that. All right, there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise, measure the temple of God. Okay, so one thing that's settled then, and this is where one segment of Bible expositor and so on go wrong, is there are those that believe that the fulfillments of things in the book of Revelation have already been fulfilled. Okay, this, they would say, was fulfilled when Titus in 70 AD came through and destroyed the temple and so on and so forth. Okay, you start having trouble in Matthew 24. There are people that say that that's the abomination of desolation and the second coming and all those things. Those things have already happened in history. Okay, it's a bunch of baloney. The problem is that, once again, as we've talked about before, there are things in the Bible that are sometimes partially fulfilled in history or in type, and then are more fully fulfilled later on, okay? Some things are as a foretype fulfilled. For instance, you know, sometimes with the abomination of desolation, you know, there's a thing in history brought up about a fellow that goes into the temple and slays a pig on the altar, which happened, and defiles the holy place. That's history. That did happen. And so all those expositors go back, and that's the abomination that maketh desolate, so it's already happened in the past. And usually these people wind up being post-millennialists or amillennialists, meaning that there is no millennium in one case other than the millennium you're living in now, that we're bringing in the kingdom as we speak, and that this is the kingdom. Okay? And by the way, the Pope is essentially at times an amillennialist and at times a postmillennialist. Sometimes there's not a real clear distinction between them. But the Pope believes that he's ruling and reigning as the vicar of Christ right now. That's why you never hear the Roman Catholic Church say much about the second coming of Christ. I mean, they have it stashed away in a dark little corner in case a Protestant brings it up. And they can bring it out and paraded around, but what they really believe is that Jesus Christ comes with each Eucharist. Okay? And the Pope believes that he's the guy. That's been the issue with the Roman Catholic Church throughout history, is it's felt that it was God's agent on earth, and it was its job to either bring in the kingdom of postmillennialism, or that the kingdom was already here, and this is it. And that Christ comes daily and weekly and so on and so forth. All right? But what this shows you is that there has to be a temple yet built, right? Now, show you a couple things here real quick, and there's some really plain prophecy with it all, but you know, people will look at a scenario, historians will look at a scenario today that we live in, and look at Jerusalem and all of the contemporary stuff that's going on with the Holy Mount and all that, the Mosque of Omar sitting there and all that. And most, I imagine that most secular people, you know, that would read something like this and hear us talk about a still forthcoming temple of God on the Holy Mount would laugh us to scorn. Because what it sure looks like is that that ain't never going to happen. I mean, that place over there is a tinder box, or worse, it's nitroglycerin and dynamite and matches in a hot little shed, and you know, it's just a mess. And they can't foresee you know, some sort of a scenario where a temple can be built, but it's going to be built. For instance, look in Daniel chapter 9 here, just a second. Daniel chapter 9. Daniel chapter 9, go down towards the end of the passage, and this is regarding, of course, the Daniel's 70th week. We understand these things. There are 70 weeks determined, and well, let's pick it up here. Notice verse 25, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. 62 weeks is 62, plus 7 weeks is 69 weeks. Right? Say, why did he do it that way? I don't know. But he did. But there are 69 weeks right there. "The street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times." All right, verse 26. "After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off." Okay? So after the 69th week, Jesus Christ was cut off and killed, right? That's not hard to figure out. Everybody with me? Maybe it is hard to figure out. Look, I'm sick. If I can add, you can add. Okay, just answer these questions. "After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary." Jesus Christ was killed. And it was fairly shortly in time thereafter that Titus did come and did destroy the temple so that there was not one stone left upon another, right? So we have no temple today. Okay, keep going. "The end thereof shall be with a flood, and to the end of the war desolations are determined. And then, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week." That's the 70th week. A week of years. This is a week of days, but a week of years. So we know that the tribulation at various points is seven years long. "He'll confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease." Sacrifice, oblation, well, that's something done at a temple, and God would never allow it to be done any other place than at the temple. So without telling you so, after Messiah is cut off and the people of the prince that shall come destroy the temple, there's going to be another temple built in which the sacrifices and the oblations are put back in place. Then in the middle of the week, it's stopped again. And notice, "And for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate." You see what I'm saying? Messiah the prince is cut off. He destroys the prince of they that shall come, of the people that shall come, destroy the sanctuary. But then it says that during the 70th week, that those oblations and sacrifices are back. Well, there's a new temple. See what I'm saying? Go back to Matthew chapter 24. I know you're pretty familiar with this. Matthew. Matthew 24. And verse 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand where? In the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let him that be in Judea flee of the mountains. Well, there's a holy place. Well, that holy place, first times, any of the times that the holy place is mentioned, first anyway, there's some other applications to it. In in Exodus, folks, that's the tabernacle, that's the temple. Okay, that's the holy place. Yes, there's a most holy place, we call it the Holy of Holies, but inside the veil, where the mercy seat is and the ark and all that. But the holy place was also, sometimes referred to not just as that next room out where the candle and the showbread and the altar of incense stood, but also sometimes the holy place included the court outside. And so, it's talking about a tabernacle type scenario, which was fulfilled in the temple, right? And if this thing is set in the holy place, then the temple's back. And that's the future. Because the whole issue here in Matthew 24 was, what shall be the end of the world? Well, folks, really, if the end of the world was completely fulfilled anyway in 33 to 70 AD, what are you doing here in 2009 of all things, knocking the door of another decade in 2010, right? There's another temple to be built. Let's look at one more, and then I'll let you guys go on this. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And I don't know exactly how it's going to come to pass. I know that there's going to be a big covenant signed when the right guy comes along. He's going to find some way to, at least for 3.5 years, see to it that the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians and then all the other secular people around come to an agreement about things. And part of that agreement is going to have to be about the Temple Mount location. That's not all the agreement, I'm sure, but part of that agreement has to be settled there. Is it still true that a Jew can't set foot on the Can't set foot up there, can he, at this point? They still have that in place? A Jew can't set foot on the Temple Mount. I think they're restricted there by that wall, where you always see those Jews in that plaza, leaving their little prayer requests and those guys, standing and praying, like this. But as far as setting foot beyond that, up on the Holy Mount, anywhere near that mosque, they can't even go up there. Well, somebody's got to come along that takes the peace process forward enough so that the Jews can build there. And apparently, it may well be built under the guise of some ungodly scenario where, this covenant, in the making and so on, where the Muslims are happy enough to let the Jews. So I don't know what makes a Muslim happy enough to have the Jews build somewhere on that site. It's always been debated whether the mosque actually has to be gone or not. I don't really know. Okay, there's different opinions about that stuff. And one of the opinions is that the mosque doesn't exactly sit on where the temple would be. Some claim differently. And I don't know what to think. But regardless, there's going to be a covenant signed, and there's going to be a temple built. And 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it's going to get built, and apparently, again, listening to some, and you hear all kinds of things, but there's every reason to believe that the Jews, the Jews have had an awful long time to prepare for this. And some have it that they have the stones already cut, that all material is completely set, and that would fit fine. David had everything cut and fit for Solomon. And so, they got everything cut and fit over there ready to throw it up. When it's ready, they may be able to put it up as quickly as you'd put up a tent if the go-ahead ever comes. So it may not be, you might not be but months, mere months, a few months from actually having a temple scenario back. And so that's what I mean. When you read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means. That day shall not come except there come a falling away first, that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. That passage has always caused a great amount of dispute amongst pre-trib, pre-millennial Bible-believing Christians, because they get concerned about, well, what does it mean that we will, that the man of sin will be revealed to us? That mean that we have to go all the way, you know, halfway through the tribulation in order to see him and all that kind of stuff? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that you're going to know probably who the man of sin, son of perdition, is. And folks, if you're close enough, you're mere months away from this moment right now, if the okay was given, for basically temple worship, being able to be back in, you know, back in. Well, it's, you know, you don't have to be very far away from that, you know, before you realize that, you know, Antichrist could be around now, and we could get out of here, and they could be doing this tribulation stuff in maybe weeks. So, anyway, verse 4, though, is what we were looking for. Who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God. Somebody's going to come, this man of sin, the son of perdition, and there's a guy in history named Antiochus Epiphanes. And he came in to the temple mount, slew a pig, and defiled, I mean, this is in history, he was a Syrian, I believe, and which is interesting. But, you know, he defiled the temple there. And so to a lot of these people who think it's all in the past and nothing prophetic in the future, you know, then he was the fulfillment of it, and that's all there was to it. All the rest of this is allegorical stuff, and it's not true. It was merely partially fulfilled, even as a shadow, fulfilled as a shadow in type before the real thing comes. And the real guy is the Antichrist, and he will, as God, sit in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And you can't miss the cross-reference to Isaiah 14 with that, with the devil saying basically those very words. So anyway, there's going to be another temple. Look at 11:1, Revelation 11:1. It was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood saying, rise, measure the temple of God. Now this is not the same temple as you find in verse 19. The temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament. That's not the same one. Okay, it can't be. This one is one on earth. Verse 1. Rise, measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court, which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not. For it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread under foot 42 months. Now this is in connection with Luke 21 real quick. Luke chapter 21. Luke 21 verse 24. And actually notice the context, verse 20. This is still, the context is the abomination of desolation. And she'll see Jerusalem compassed with armies. Then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. It's the same verbiage as Matthew 24. It's the same context. Let them which are in the midst of it depart out. Let not them that are in the countries enter thereunto. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are with child, to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. They shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, there's a fulfillment of that in history. I mean, a partial fulfillment, a shadow fulfillment, you know, when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. But the wrath of God falls again, more specifically on a pinpoint, on that people in the Great Tribulation. It's a time of God's wrath. It's a time of Jacob's trouble. And so it still has yet to be fully prophetically fulfilled. You see what I'm saying? And notice, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Well, back in Revelation 11:2, the holy city shall the Gentiles tread underfoot 42 months. 42 months. Okay, 42 months is exactly 3.5 years on the dime, right? And you keep running into this 3.5 years thing all the time. You run into it again in verse 3. I give power to my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days. You divide 1260 by 30, and you get exactly 42 months. And divide 42, you know, and you'll come up with exactly 3.5 years. So this is something. This is a formula that shows up all the time in Revelation. It shows up all the time in Daniel. The Great Tribulation is 7 years. And there is a time mark somewhere in the middle, 3.5 years. Well, that you know, mid-trib. It's. I mean, this thing is written in stone. All right, back to verse 2. But the court which is without the temple leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles and the holy city, and they shall tread up that they blah. Shall they tread underfoot 42 months? And I should bring this up. A few years back, there's a Bible believer that brought this up, and you know, he's a good man, really is. I don't agree with him, but he decided that since 3.5 years, it's a key thing, right? How long Jesus Christ was here for the better part of 33.5 years. How long was he, though? How long did he minister? 3.5 years. And so what this guy developed when Jesus Christ shows up, repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand, right? And so what he said is that basically since Jesus Christ declared that the kingdom of heaven was at hand, not just the kingdom of God, the spiritual kingdom, but the kingdom of heaven, right? The physical, material kingdom. Since he said it was at hand, well, then it was at hand. And then since Jesus Christ was here for 3.5 years, basically his life was the fulfillment, the time of his life was the fulfillment, the time of his ministry, 3.5 years, was the fulfillment of the first 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. So actually all that's left is the final 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. And what I think about that, and you know, run it through what little computer I have, but it seems to me that that won't work, because then you have an issue of, you know, how's that going to work if you still have to build a temple and establish sacrifice in the temple again, have the abomination of desolation sat by the Antichrist, have that cease, and then still have 3.5. Well, you know, you got to have the first 3.5 years of the tribulation in the future for that to happen, for the final to happen. And I tell you what I think. I think that I believe that it's just like John the Baptist coulda, shoulda, woulda been been Elijah. Okay? In fact, Jesus said, Elias has come, but you killed him. Okay? Guess what? Elijah's still coming. Right? Okay, so what I believe is that all the blocks were set in place for the second coming of Christ, the second coming of Christ at his first coming, if it had so happened. But it didn't. And so some of the fulfillments of the first 3.5 years of his coming is basically a fulfillment in foretype, a partial fulfillment, which will again be repeated and completed for the final 7 years. Okay? That's what I think. I think that that all those prophecies were then rewound and largely have to be done again, because Elijah's coming back. Well, some would argue, oh, Elijah was already here. So how are you going to, you know, he has to, we're seeing in this passage, he has to be here, he has to be killed, he has to rise from the dead after 3.5 days. Ugh. Right? By the way, when was Moses here? Moses shows up in the Great Tribulation. If Jesus Christ, I mean, what? You see what I'm saying? So that's what I think. I'm just warning you that, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, playing with numbers, trying to figure out when the second coming is. And there's a lot of typology in here that you can get off on, and it's really sweet meat if you'll take it and measure and realize just how intricate God's plan was. But if you get caught up in it too far and start, you know, wanting your own way with it, then you can get messed up and become a heretic and mislead the people of God, right? So I believe there's still 7 years of the Great Tribulation, notwithstanding that Jesus Christ came, was here for 3.5 years, the kingdom of heaven was at hand. I believe the kingdom of heaven has to come back at hand at the beginning of the tribulation again. And Jesus Christ doesn't come back to die again. That was fulfilled, but there are things that still have to be fulfilled in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation that were in part fulfilled in the first 3.5 years of Jesus Christ's life. But that since they weren't, it wasn't complete, the picture still has to come together in the future. We still got to have a temple built. Right? Did I just blow everybody away? I'm babbling. I have, you know, drugs in my system. Yes, sir. I do not know. Somebody said something to me the other day. I know the Nostradamus people have determined 2012 is a big year. Aztec, well, there you go. But Nostradamus was supposed to have some stuff going in 2012. I've been, you know, we've been up there with cable for a few days. And I noticed on the History Channel they had Nostradamus stuff going again. They're never going to quit the Nostradamus stuff. And yeah, Aztec calendars. So I don't know. You know, 2012 would be fine. 2009 would be better. All right. 11:2. But the court which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. So. I guess the picture that you're drawing, you're between, keep in mind where you are, you're in the trumpets, and you're between the sixth and seventh trumpet. So you are now being informed of some things that are in place late in the tribulation between the sixth and seventh trumpet. Because at the seventh trumpet, verse 15, 11:15, great voices in heaven saying, kingdom of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. He shall reign forever and ever. Okay, that's the millennium. Okay? So what you're reading here is some stuff that may not be commenced, you know, after the sixth trumpet, but at least at that point are in place. Verse 2, it's given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. Apparently, the way I understand it is the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, you got this prince that came, signed a covenant. Jews and the Muslims and the Catholics all get along just fine, just fine, just wonderful. And at the halfway mark of the 7 years, the Antichrist comes, places the abomination that maketh desolate, and from that point the Gentiles tread the temple court and so on underfoot for 42 months, 3.5 years. Now, you know, give or take. I don't know how much you can give and take here. But let's keep reading, see if you can figure out a timeline. Verse 3. I'll give power unto my two witnesses. And this embarks on a passage. You know, you go back to Zechariah chapter 4 here in a second. And Zechariah chapter 4 must have read like what does all this mean, you know, right? Then you get to the New Testament, though. I'll give power unto my two witnesses. And they shall prophesy 260 days, clothed in sackcloth. Now, I don't believe there's any question in my mind. This is Elijah and Moses, and they are two witnesses. Remember, they were the two fellows that showed up at the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew 17. Jesus Christ takes his inner circle up there, Peter, James, and John, and so on, and he's transfigured before their eyes. They fall on their faces, and when they look up, they see Jesus Christ talking to Moses and Elias. Well, those are those two witnesses, right? All right, I'll give power unto my two witnesses. Interestingly enough, two witnesses only show up a couple or three times in the Bible. It's interesting. Go back to Deuteronomy 17 real quick. Deuteronomy 17. We are accustomed to quoting the passage, you know, at the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every, you know, word be established and so on. Deuteronomy 17. And notice verse 6, at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. The hands of the witnesses shall be first upon him. And it's interesting, isn't it, that you know, like I said, there's only three places in the Bible, and the two in the Old Testament are basically this context, where, you know, in the Old Testament there had to be two witnesses or three for you to put a man to death. Well, here show up two witnesses, and they put to death whomsoever they will. Verse 3. I'll give power unto my two witnesses. They shall prophesy 1,200, 80 days, clothed in sackcloth. Okay, that's 42 months. Now, I believe he placed this between the sixth trumpet and the seventh trumpet, because I believe that the sequence with these two witnesses basically is the last half of the 3.5 years. Again, I don't know if it's, you know, on the exact mark, or if there's some overlap. You know, I'm not beyond thinking there might be a little bit of an overlap, or whatever. God can do what he wants to. But as far as drawing rough lines, the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, things go pretty good. There's a covenant in place. And then at the end of the 3.5, here comes the man of sin, the son of perdition, places the abomination of desolation, defiles the temple. And from that point on, it gets really bad. And at that point, the Jews are supposed to flee from Jerusalem, and they have to be, you know, for 3.5 years, specially taken care of in the wilderness. These two witnesses prophesy 42 months, 1,260 days. It has to be the last part of the tribulation, because he puts it here, and the next sequence that he tells you is that the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ. And he shall reign forever and ever, right? All right. Verse 4. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. All right. This is Zechariah chapter 4. Go back to Zechariah. And again, trying to make sense of this, you know, before you knew where it fit, would have been a real chore. It's no wonder that it's a complete mystery to the Jews. Okay, Zechariah chapter 4. I'm about to read the whole thing, but verse 1, the angel that talked with me came again and waked me as a man that is waking out of his sleep, said to me, "What seest thou?" I have looked, and behold, a candlestick, all of gold, with a bowl on the top of it, his seven lamps thereon, seven pipes, the seven lamps to supply the oil, which are upon the top thereof, and two olive trees by it, one upon the right side of the bowl, the other upon the left side thereof. And I answered and spake unto the angel and talked with me, saying, "What are these, my Lord?" The angel that talked with me answered and said unto me, "Knowest thou not what these be?" No, that's why I asked you. Verse 6, he answered and spake, "This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts." Zerubbabel was the governor of Judah during the time of the rebuilding of the temple during Ezra and Nehemiah's time. Okay, and apparently he found his way back here. But it doesn't end there. And it kind of falls apart there, and you wonder, well, I don't even know what that means. Well, again, continue verse 8, 9, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, his hands shall also finish it, so on and so forth. Verse 11, then answered I, and said unto him, What are these two olive trees? And still stuck on the olive trees because he didn't get the answer that he wanted. What are these two olive trees upon the right side of the candlestick and upon the left side thereof? And I answered again and said unto him, What be these two olive branches which through the two golden pipes empty the golden oil out of themselves? And he answered me and said, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my Lord. Then he said, These are the two anointed ones that stand by the Lord of the whole earth. Well, they're not called anointed ones in Revelation chapter 11, verse 4, but they are called the two olive trees. And they are specified to be standing before the God of the earth, right? Okay, see, these are them. Verse 5, if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. If any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. So you're talking about the ultimate here. You remember John says to Jesus, can we just call fire down from heaven and kill them? And Jesus said, well, you don't know what spirit you're of, right? Well, here's a case. I mean, apparently what John was thinking about was something like this. He's probably thinking about Elijah calling down fire from heaven. He's probably thinking about Moses, who, when he raised his rod at least one time, that there was a hail and that fire ran along the ground and, you know, and did damage, right? So he's probably thinking about that. Here's a case, though, where you have two witnesses, and at the mouth of two witnesses, let every word be established. And I mean, you stand in these guys' ways, you're going to be fried. It's interesting, isn't it? It's very interesting. That's called firepower. And verse 5, any man shall hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies, whether they literally spit fire or whether the words that they speak are as a burning fire shut up in their bones and that God thus destroys them, I'm not sure. I know that fire came out from before the Lord and killed Phinehas' two sons, right? Or, no, Phinehas and what's the other guy's name? You're biblical illiterate, just like me this morning. All right. Anyway, two guys got burned up, right, that built strange fire. All right. Well, whether or not these guys speak, I'm sorry? That's him. Yeah, who's Phinehas? That's it. Okay. I get my characters confused, but whether fire literally comes out of their mouth or whether it's the word that goes out and the Lord burns them that way, I don't know for sure. I mean, maybe it could be either way, maybe not. Verse 5, devoureth their enemies. If any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power. And this is where you can really come down and figure out who these two guys are. There's some people that argue, and they don't have a leg to stand on as far as I'm concerned. Well, one of these witnesses has to be Enoch. Because it's appointed unto men once to die, and after this the judgment, and Enoch has never died. And that's fine. Enoch would be, if what I'm saying is right, the one exception. It never said in the Bible that every single man that was ever born in this life has to die. It didn't say that. The general rule is it's appointed unto men once to die, and after this the judgment. If Enoch is the one that comes back, then the church is left with no foretype at all in the Bible. Because the church is the one body that will get out of here without dying. There is a group in this body, may probably sit here today, that will not die, not just eternally, not just spiritually, but period. They will be taken out. They will be translated like Enoch. He is a type of us. All right? So I don't believe it's Enoch at all. And if you say, well, I don't know if it's Elijah and Moses, why wouldn't you think it was Elijah and Moses? I mean, those are the two that showed up. I mean, Jesus Christ said there'd be some standing here that are going to see the kingdom, the Son of Man coming in power and glory. And within mere days, Peter, James, and John went up on a Mount of Transfiguration, saw Jesus Christ transfigured, so to what he'll look like when he comes back the second time, speaking with Moses and Elijah. Why wouldn't you think it was Moses and Elijah? Verse 6. These have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of their prophecy. They have power to do that. So there will be a great drought, a 3.5-year drought, I believe, in the Great Tribulation. Elijah did that here already. I mean, that was what the whole issue was with Ahab. He, for 3.5 years, prophesied, and it did not rain for 3.5 years. And it goes on to say, verse 6, they have power over waters to turn them to blood. Moses did that. Why would you identify these two guys as anybody other than Elijah and Moses? I don't understand. These have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, have power over waters to turn them to blood, and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. Here is Elijah sits on the top of a mountain. The king, you know, is sending to the false gods to find out, you know, if he's going to recover from his illness. And, sends a captain and his 50, and Elijah says, you know, let fire come down from heaven and destroy you. And it did. And the next captain and his 50, and fire came down from heaven and destroyed them. And on the third time, though, the third captain has learned his lesson, and he gets down on his knees and says, don't kill me, please, please. I'm just following orders here. And the Bible says at that point, you've not been aware of it, but at that point, an angel speaks to Elijah and says it's safe to go with him. So that angel, the angel of the Lord, has been calling the shots for the calling down of the fire from heaven to destroy those 102 men. Right? Okay. Well, they do it as they will at the end of verse 6. I believe the Lord's speaking to them. Destroy him. Speak the word there. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth up out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, shall overcome them, and kill them. All right, here's a few more things on Moses and Elijah. Okay, they both stand by the Lord of the earth. They actually both, and when it came to dealing with their enemies, they both dealt with fire, as I said before. Moses called down fire from heaven, and fire ran along the ground, if you recall that in Egypt. Elijah also dealt with fire. They both did call down plagues and drought. They both were 40 days on Mount Sinai, both of them. They both fasted for 40 days on Mount Sinai. Each of them were succeeded by great types of Christ. Moses by Joshua, and Elijah by Elisha, right? Each of them was on the Mount of Transfiguration. I mentioned that. Both of them show up in Malachi. Go to Malachi chapter 4. One of the last things the Lord said to anybody, at least in the church's New Testament, you probably don't know it. Well, you probably do know it. But the Jews' Old Testament does not end like yours does. The Jewish Old Testament ends with 2 Chronicles, with Cyrus the king pronouncing, whoever go back and build the temple, which is interesting. But notice when the Lord shifted the books around, and the Lord did it, look in Malachi chapter 4, verse 4. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. He shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. So just before, in a passage that begins back in verse 1, for behold, the day cometh that will burn as an oven. Verse 2, but unto you that fear my name shall the Son, capital S, Son, right? Son of righteousness arise with healing in his wings, not its wings, his wings, it's Jesus Christ. In a passage that very plainly prophesies the second coming of Jesus Christ, who's there? Moses and Elijah. Like I said, this is not really hard to piece together here at all. All right. Both those guys, by the way, died east of Jordan. Both of them preached to great types of the Antichrist. Moses to Pharaoh, Elijah to Ahab. And by the way, for what it's worth, Jezebel, who was, Ahab's wife in Elijah's day, is one of our characters back in Revelation chapter 2. Well, all this stuff comes back around, and I don't know if you've ever stopped to think about it, but the book of James that gives Christians so much trouble because of the whole works thing in there and all that, you know who the last character mentioned in James 5 is? Elijah. Talking about what? Talking about the fact that he called down a drought from heaven for 3.5 years and so on and so forth. It's a second coming book. It's kind of cool. All right. Back to verse 7. We're going to have to quit. When they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit. It doesn't say that he ascends out of the bottomless pit to destroy them. It's a descriptive. It's saying that the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them. It doesn't say that he comes out of the bottomless pit to make war against them, that he's just the one that came out of the bottomless pit and does make war against them. In other words, you're still between the sixth and seventh trumpet. And it's not saying that it's at the end of the tribulation the beast comes out of the bottomless pit to make war against them. It's just identifying that this is the beast that came out of the bottomless pit that makes war against them. That's not part of a timeline. Because that has to happen somewhere, back in the middle of the tribulation. Verse 7, I didn't check how the New Bibles probably messed that up, but the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them. Pretty bad when you have to make war against two guys. That's pretty good. I mean, two fellows, and he has to make war against them. So they have power. Shall overcome them and kill them. We'll have to stop there. Any questions real quick? Okay, take a break.